Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts, just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
And it looks like all hell has broken loose in Hydra HQ. Things are not going well. Well, yes. I guess it's about evenly. Well, let's get into it more. I'll go into what all this action's going on all around.
There is a lot of action, and everybody's involved.
Mayhem. Yes,
the war is in full swing. Minute 97. In a Hydra corridor, Dum-Dum Dugan wields a stolen energy weapon, vaporizing several Hydra soldiers as he, Gabe Jones, and Falsworth press forward. At the base's entrance, Peggy Carter and allied forces storm the motor pool. Hydra troops retreat toward the complex, their energy weapons disintegrating several allies, but their numbers dwindle rapidly under the onslaught. In another corridor, the Red Skull glimpses allied soldiers breaching an entrance. He snatches an energy weapon, fires a barrage at the advancing troops, and flees deeper into the complex. A small squad of Hydra soldiers charges the allies in a narrow hallway, only to be cut down by a hail of bullets. One zealous Hydra soldier mid-charge shouts, "Cut off one head, two more shall." A gunshot from Colonel Phillips drops him mid-sentence. "Let's go find two more," Phillips barks, rallying his men. Steve Rogers pursues the Red Skull closely, deflecting energy bolts with his vibranium shield. The Red Skull ducks behind two closing metal doors, but Steve hurls his shield, which ricochets off a wall and lodges between the doors, jamming them open. The Hydra soldier with twin flamethrowers blocks Steve's path, unleashing torrents of flame down the corridor. Steve dives into a vestibule, narrowly avoiding the scorching blaze. The flamethrower advances, but Peggy Carter appears, machine gun in hand, and guns the soldier down. Go, Peggy.
I was trying to figure out what kind of shotgun shells Colonel Phillips is using. Are those like deer slugs? Because they're getting blown off their feet. it's pretty hard to do that with a shotgun.
It's a big boom. It's a big elephant gun he's got there.
Let's see. Yeah, I'm trying to. What second are we talking about there?
It's right around the middle, I think, or just a little bit past the middle.
Scrubbing through here.
I know
it's about 40. 30,
yeah.
30.
There he is. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's definitely a short short barrel.
Yeah, short barrel, single. Yeah.
Yeah. So pump action. I mean, and looks like it. It could be still in that Remington 870 family. It's just they always look so different when the barrels are cut like that. But yeah, those could be slugs.
I'm thinking it's got to be if he's knocking them that way, and he's it's right. Definitely under like 100 yards.
Yeah, he's not.
We just noticed we don't actually see it firing. We see the result of the fire knocking the guy back, but we don't see
Yeah, that's true.
Anything coming out of the barrel,
and. I don't know. The fact that he's not aiming, if this were real life, I would say he's almost certainly using something like buckshot because you don't have to be very precise. But with a slug, even at fairly close range, shooting anything, any sort of single projectile without really looking down the barrel is not.
Well, if you're as good as Phillips is.
But if you're as good as Phillips and it's a movie.
This is just it's a great Tommy Lee Jones reveal here, though, when it's Colonel Phillips going into action, and he's just itching to get out from behind the desk and go into action.
Right.
Yeah.
The whole movie's been in. If the movie were about him, this would be his hero moment.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was surprised at how fast the other soldiers are running in front of him downrange. So I guess they know that all four of them are down, but it's like, they don't really have a good discipline on that. Let me get ahead of you, guy. I know you're still waving that thing around, but
Yeah, quick, before you shoot again, let me get between you and the target. It's fine.
Good point. But this is watching this minute back in preparation for this episode. This is as close as this movie gets to Saving Private Ryan. This is its storming the beaches moment.
Yeah.
And obviously it's not that serious, it's not that grim, it's but it, I think you use the word mayhem in your intro, and I think that's exactly right. It's just all hell's breaking loose. At this point in the battle, we don't really know who's going to win because our boys still have to breach the compound. And man, the cannon fodder, we're good guys are getting disintegrated right and left. It's brutal.
Yeah. The other thing I did want to point out with the fellow that, that Colonel Phillips sends to his maker, that is a Joe Johnston thing that we've seen in October Sky, where there's a cable pulling the guy back, and it just looks, and I think Joe learned from filming October Sky not to shoot them from behind because you can see the cable. So he always pulled them away from the frame rather than into the frame. But yeah, it's quite a mayheminous thing. The other thing that keeps hitting me is the blue that we've learned is part of the Tesseract power. This, I think, is the first scene that we've seen Tesseract powered lighting in the building. It just looks like he developed the fluorescent light, Tesseract powered fluorescent lights.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah. And there's my assumption of how they use the Tesseract. But you're right, it is a mix. There's some white lights, but there's also the blue glow. I think Schmidt has been just siphoning off, milligrams of this blue power, and a milligram of power will power a factory, or a tank or a gun, or I don't know if he's found a way to duplicate it or use a little bit to make more of it, or if he's just pulling it out another dimension through the Tesseract. It's very unclear how this all works, but this little cube that's, 6 by 6 by 6 inches or something, has an unlimited amount of power. If you divide it among 100,000 guns and enough power to run the night lights in the station.
And if memory serves, the Infinity Stones were created just after the Big Bang. Is that the way? They've been around for a long time. I just didn't
I'd
know
have
if
to
they
look it up. They
if
might
they,
have
they harness the elemental
Big Bang.
Yeah, the elemental power of the universe, I think, is where it came from. So it may be like pulling stuff through time and space. I keep thinking about how many, many minutes ago we talked with, Dr. Zola was talking about how he had all these different designs that needed the Tesseract's power. So I don't know how far he was getting into like HVAC systems or basic infrastructure, but maybe he just thought, I can make a light bulb out of this.
Yeah. I'm waiting for a Tesseract toaster.
Yeah. You knock that off in an afternoon.
Yeah. I kind of wonder if, this is a theory that'd probably be shot down pretty easily, but I wonder if there's sort of a wireless power transmission element to it.
Oh,
like if
I
you've got
that.
The Tesseract and, we build the right sort of receivers, it runs everything. I mean, the guns could be drawing their power from it. If we ever saw a scene where some of the Hydra guys got too far from this compound and the gun didn't work or something, then maybe that would
be an intriguing thing. Yeah.
Be interesting to think that through. Because it's hard to imagine, as you said, taking this, precious, priceless, the one of the greatest MacGuffins ever, and like shaving off a little bit of it to do this, and carving off a splinter to give to the guys to load their gun. It's hard to picture that happening.
Right.
I don't know.
I get the feeling it's like that blue power is some kind of a fluid of some kind that it regenerates.
It seems
out
like
of the
that, yeah.
Because all if you're looking at the Hydra soldiers that are out in the motor pool, they've all got those little boxes with blue triangles inside of a box. So I'm just wondering if that's just showing how much blue Tesseract energy is stored in a Tesseract battery or something.
So to answer questions we ask to save our listeners the trouble, the internet is telling me that the Infinity Stones were forged from six primordial singularities that existed before the universe. So they, as I suggested, did precede the Big Bang. Hmm. And the Big Bang formed them into these crystals, these primordial energies that predate our universe. So take from that what you will, but they are nearly infinitely powerful.
They're run by plot armor to keep going.
Yes, exactly. So if the would you guys expect that each of each of these elements would have that same amount of power? Like, is there something so special about the blue one that lets it do all these other applications?
Well, they are specialized, though. They have specialized purposes. True.
There's infinity and time. And yeah,
exactly. Right. There's space, mind, reality, power, time, that's soul. Right. And how some of these act is very vague in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. There's a lot more information about it in the comics themselves, because you might have a 12-issue comic series just focused on the Soul Stone or something like that. But we see a lot of the Time Stone through Doctor Strange.
Right.
We know that the Mind Stone is housed in Loki's scepter and later becomes the gem in Vision's forehead. And the Tesseract is the Space Stone. Now, I don't know how you tap that energy, turn it into guns, and I'm not sure the MCU really thought this out either.
Yeah, well, and we see that the Space Stone, well, that's in a future minute, but that it does open up portals in space. So that might have been its primary use, and Red Skull came up with just a more pedestrian application for it.
Well, somehow Palpatine survived, and somehow Zola invented Tesseract guns.
I was watching the attack. I was watching guys get disintegrated like one frame at a time, and the animation of the disintegration is just a horrific occasion, but terrific animation. It seems like in just a few frames, the animation, we might have talked about this in a previous minute, it was a long time ago, the animation sort of carries on the momentum of what the character was doing when they were hit by the blue bolt for just a split second. So it really looks almost like you said earlier, almost liquid, almost like they turn into this plasma, you know. It's really well done, I think, very thoughtfully done.
It does look like it, to me it looks, when you frame by frame through it, it looks like the blue glow travels along the nervous system, like you just see all their nerves light up. And so and then you just evaporate into the ether. Very reminiscent of the monster from the id in if a different color, but definitely a monster from the id from Forbidden Planet.
That's a great callback. I really like that, Jim. That's smart. You're right. I didn't get the nervous system part, but that's exactly what it looks like. It looks like it lights up your nervous system and then you kind of disintegrate out, but it all happens in a fraction of a second. So you're subliminally processing and receiving this information like, oh God, that looked like it hurt. analyzing it is really interesting. Somebody behind a computer spent a long time figuring out what that should look like, how it should look different from like a phaser hit in Star Trek or something else.
Yeah, and it looks kind of wet. It's like you kind of splash when you go. You're gonna get splashed out of existence.
Well, and just the fact that it holds up to, you know, effectively frame by frame, scrubbing too, you know, there's so many effects that if you did go down to that level and scrub through, it's like, okay, there's the jump cut. That's when, you know, somebody came in and started, you know, scribbling on the negative with a felt pen, but it looks just as good no matter how slowly you watch it.
And tying it in over the practical effects that are happening on the ground, all the squibs going off and the canisters firing the dirt up in the air to show, you know, explosions. So you're having practical on top of the VFX. It's just a great marriage of the two. Great work by the VFX editors.
I wanted to ask you guys' opinion on something weapons related, because you're more gunny than I am. But these blue glowing energy weapons are more or less just line of sight weapons. If you see something, you should be able to kill it instantly. You know, there's no reason to aim. It's just a laser. And I think of things like Superman's heat vision or, you know, Cyclops energy blasts that come out of his eyes. You should be able to hit anything you can see. And this isn't quite that, because they do come out of guns and so forth. But it's sort of, for me, again, I just brought up phasers. It's sort of the Star Trek phaser thing. If Star Trek phasers were real, they would be an unbeatable weapon. And I'm kind of wondering why Hydra is losing this fight with, they've got these blue, glowy laser weapons that ought to just, you ought to be able to sweep and kill 100 people in a tenth of a second.
They're not at light speed, though. You can see the bolts traveling through the air. They're traveling like really fast arrows, maybe. They're not even as fast as a bullet.
They're actually slower than bullets. And people have done the math on phaser shots. And a phaser shot is slower, way slower than light, but slower than a bullet. But I think they're kind of meant to look like that? I don't know. It's interesting to me. I my basic question is, why is Hydra losing this fight? With these weapons, they should just decimate the allies.
Well, the first answer to that, of course, is they're the bad guys, Brian. Yeah. so ergo, Manifest Destiny and all of that. But yeah, with respect to the weapons, where they are, you know, they're shooting a single, you know, a single bolt. I mean, it's
a bolt.
Also a
You're
bit
right.
like a, you know, like a blaster in Star Wars shoots a separate thing. One
yeah,
would think,
right.
though, I mean, if we've already determined, okay, that they've got this basically limited power at their fingertips, why not just make a fully automatic, you know, constant stream, not even automatic, but just one constant stream, you know, blue tesseract gun, disintegrate everybody and move on with our evil plans. No, yep. Just one big sweep and you're absolutely right. We'd be done.
But don't you get the feeling it's like a flash unit that you have to like charge some kind of a capacitor.
Yeah.
It doesn't
yeah.
seem like it's an instant thing, but
it'll like
get
I don't
there.
Think it's gonna I don't think you could sit there and just yank jerk on the trigger as fast as you could and expect multiple bolts to come out. There's that sense of it does have to recharge. And you know, with our we have an upcoming minute talking with our composer Tom Geyer about how sounds get associated with things, and I get thinking about it, and I there's that sort of that click and that spool up whine that somewhere in reasonably recent years, I don't know, 20 years or something like that, we've all agreed means something electronic, maybe slightly futuristic, charging up.
And, something's you know, charging,
being,
yeah.
Being ready yeah. to go again. And that would be an interesting one to sort of rabbit hole on that a bit. So when's the first time we heard that and why, you know, I don't think I have, like, I don't think my leaf blower makes that noise when I plug it in to charge the battery or something, you know, but what?
No, but a flash would.
A flash. If you hold a flash next to your ear, you can hear that the oscillator heating up.
Yeah.
A capacitor.
Yeah, that's
loads.
Probably exactly where it came from. Yeah.
That's what the sound is. Yeah.
Older style flash, camera flash. Well, and there we go. Asked and answered, Your Honor.
And like you were saying about hitting anything you aim, this reminds me of that gun that Zorg had in the Fifth Element that he was selling to the lizard creatures. It was, you could fire and forget these little energy bolts that would go anywhere you shot. It would hit the same target. If you, the first place you shot, it had like a memory feature, but I think that's probably what Red Skull wanted, but didn't have time to implement.
Right. Well, if you think about it, I mean, something like that requires, you know, an amount of or level of miniaturization and electronic sophistication that, you know, it's one thing to say, okay, we've got this Tesseract power, and I feel like I'm just rationalizing everything for Hydra here, but we've got the Tesseract power and we can find a way to sort of put it in a gun and then like point it at somebody, but precision targeting, tracking, things like that, you know, the electronics world wasn't there yet at this point.
Yeah. So maybe,
well, you make a good point. I'm picturing these guns full of tubes, vacuum tubes. Yeah,
exactly. Maybe a Nixie tube counter that shows you how many, how much Tesseract juice you have left. And
that's funny. That's good.
Oh goodness. Wow.
Well, so there's the bit at the end with Cap throwing the shield. I'm sorry if I'm
no. That's
taking another direction too abruptly. But the bit at the end with Cap throwing the shield is, again, as I've said many times before, just right out of the comics. And you know, I think the very first time I saw this, I thought Cap intended to block the door. Upon rewatching, I think Cap intends to hit the Red Skull and the door just gets in the way. I think him jamming that door open is just dumb luck or bad luck, because if it hadn't hit the door, he would have clocked the Red Skull.
It wasn't in his plan. His plan was knock the Red Skull down and capture him.
Yeah, right. Exactly. But I didn't take it the first time I saw it. I thought, wow, that's really cool. He somehow jammed that door around the corner he couldn't even see. But no, he's not that good.
While we're toward the end here, I just want to go to that the very last frame of this minute.
It's beautiful.
One of our guests, Rory Aylward, on, who is an armorer, and he also teaches actors how to hold and fire different kinds of weapons. And Haley did not learn to keep her eyes open when she's shooting. So you see poor Haley Atwell firing a Thompson there, and she's got her eyes like squinting as she's rat-a-tat-tatting. It's just, I guess this was the take that they had set up, and this they were going to go with this one. But
Jim, are you suggesting that Haley Atwell is less than perfect?
I don't ask her to shoot anybody. It's fine.
I think she's so good she can do it with her eyes closed.
That's true.
I think that's the kind of markswoman she is. I think she's just that good at it. That does take a lot of practice and a lot of training and a lot of willpower. You know, when we used to go out and qualify to carry weapons for the police department, we'd, you know, do night shoots. It was like every other quarter or something like that. And that, trying to condition yourself to keep your eyes open for the muzzle flash at night when it's that much brighter, and also use that split second to reacquire your sights. If this was kind of shortly before we had glow in the dark sights or anything fancy like that, just iron sights. So trying to keep your eyes open, look at that muzzle flash, have a fraction of an instant to see where you're pointed, and then re-aim. You know, and then shoot. Then if you got to close your eyes, you know, you could do that a little bit later. And, you know, it's certainly not something I ever, you know, mastered, but, you know, you got better and better at it, just learning to anticipate what that is. But, she just shoots with her eyes closed because she's cool.
Yeah. And well, the other thing about automatic weapons, like I've never fired a Thompson, but I have fired an MP5. Yeah. And when you're shooting one after another, bang, 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 it's, you know, one bang is enough, but when it's going bang, 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 it's right. Really hard to keep your eyes open while it's chugging away on your arm.
Oh. The nice thing about, relatively speaking, you know, it's a serious subject, but nice thing about the Thompson versus the MP5, I'm very fortunate to have gotten a chance to shoot both full auto. The Thompson is so perfectly balanced that even when you're just unloading it on full auto, the barrel really doesn't want to climb that much. Where I found, maybe you found something different, Joe. I felt like the MP5, it was like, bzz, and suddenly I'm pointed at the ceiling.
It goes straight up.
So, maybe that's why Haley can shoot so well with her eyes closed. It's because the gun just won't move.
Yeah, I don't know how much range time she had. But hopefully she doesn't have to do that anymore.
Still not feeling real good about this slander of Haley. I cannot countenance this.
I'm putting every ounce of good spin on it I can, Brian.
I think she did a great job in the time she had to do all this stuff. They probably just had a British armorer there working with her in Pinewood and say, here, try this. And he didn't explain it's gonna go boom, boom.
And join us on minute 97 of the Captain America Minute when Jim O'Kane patronizes Haley Atwell.
Oh, we can't win in this one. I feel very, very good about this particular minute. This is what we go to. And if you want an action movie, here's the action in the action movie. And
it's a fun minute. And we've got all the characters. We've got the Howling Commandos, not necessarily in this particular minute, but they're part of this assault team. We got Phillips. We got Haley. We got Cap, we got chasing down the Red Skull. It's all coming to a head, man. And it's very exciting and fun.
Yeah. I keep thinking of the guys coming up the rear, the Howling Interns. They're the follow along the Commandos. They're
the Howling Chuck Wagon.
Yeah, I didn't sign up for this, but it's so, you know, you can tell when they were putting this together, they probably put together a clip reel of, the Dirty Dozen and The Longest Day, and you know, this has every shot. It's everything's at waist level or below. You're not looking at anybody from above. This is all you're in the mix, and you might even be down on your knee just trying to duck to avoid the shots. A lot of them are going, when you're watching this, it goes over the midline. Brian, you've written in the past about talking about where vanishing points are and things like that. Definitely the horizon line is pointing over your head in some of these scenes.
Well, we talked about the effectiveness of the claustrophobia when we were on the train. It's the same kind of thing here, where it's not as narrow and low as the train cars were, but it's still, we're basically inside corrugated tubes.
Yeah, and just imagine trying to light something like that on a studio stage that you have to have enough light to see people. It is a beautiful from a technical point of view. It's fantastic and really just shows the artistry and the technical abilities. Also, being able to hide the best part of this is being able to hide the camera dolly built into the floor as oh, it's a railroad track, but no, that's the thing that the camera's rolling on. But a great little scene that you can forget about them making a movie while they're making a movie.
And I don't want to leave without complimenting Joe Johnston on this, because many times an action scene like this becomes chaotic enough that you can't understand what's going on. In this one, we understand exactly what's going on. We don't know the layout of the Hydra base, but we understand the relationship between the characters, who's chasing whom, who's where, who just came in, who's leaving. It's very clear, so clear you don't even have to think about it or worry about it or get confused by it. And boy, I think that's hard to do.
It is. A lot of times you'll watch movies and it's like, I don't care about anything going on the screen. It's just a lot of stuff exploding. There's buildings falling down and cascading. And it doesn't mean anything because you don't see your character in it. But here, it's definitely a struggle straight in and out, and you know who the good guys and the bad guys are. No, very, very much a part of Joe's expertise. Well, I think we talked a bunch about this minute, but if you'd like to continue that conversation that we're going on here, we're always available over at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. And if you do like our show, please don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, could you please check out our great big website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. We've got some great ones coming up shortly. So be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.